Today I want to talk to you about some work that's in the intersection of symmetry-protected topological phases, or just SPT phases, and self-correcting quantum memories. And so this is work with Stephen Bartlett, mostly, although some work with Alex and Benny as well will probably be in there. And yeah, it's Wednesday afternoon, so I hope everyone's kind of a bit relaxed and ask questions throughout as you please. Okay, so the problem we're interested in is a very old problem. It's how do we protect quantum information against noise? And right, so this is one of the oldest problems, and it's a we all know that quantum information is very fragile in practice, and if we want to sustain entanglement and coherence for, say, quantum computing, we need to find good ways of doing this. And one of the main answers comes from error correction. So quantum error correcting codes provide the main answer towards solving this problem. Namely, we choose some smart subspace of a much larger Hilbert space, and this subspace protects our information, and it also allows us to locate errors if we choose it correctly. And a lot of inspiration has been drawn from the condensed matter community, namely topological phases of matter are the primary candidates for these error-correcting codes. So the Torrid code is the most prominent example of this. And it's really the topological stability of these systems, the fact that we're encoding in global degrees of freedom, which make them good error-correcting codes. So these models are beyond local order parameters, and this makes them inherently stable. However, error correction is expensive. It has high resource overheads just to go in and do these measurements, and then even a lot of classical overhead, classical computation to decode these errors. And so the question is, how little can we do? We want to somehow get away with doing as little error correction as possible. And then the question is, how long can we store information in a system without resorting to any intervention or any active error correction? And if we found a system where we could protect information for long times, and we could grow this time by just increasing the system size, then we would have what's called a self-correcting quantum memory. So these systems kind of suppress and even kind of correct errors on their own without the need for you going in there and doing it by hand. And to follow this correspondence of error correction and topological phases, which is a property at zero temperature, we want to kind of leverage this at non-zero temperature, and we want to find self-correcting quantum memories that arise from thermally stable topological phases of matter. And I'll talk more about that as we go. So the plan for this talk is to discuss these topological phases with symmetry, namely symmetry-protected topological phases and their boundaries, and their intersection with self-correcting quantum memories. So we want to discuss the feasibility of these systems for self-correction. And so this is our new direction. We're going to try and make use of symmetry to provide protection for our systems. And so the rough outline of the talk is that we'll first give some background on what self-correcting quantum memory is, what the rules we need to satisfy, what are the rules of the game, and what are some of the interesting proposals. And then we'll talk about symmetry as a mechanism for self-correction. So I'll talk about what are these SPT phases and how stable are they. And we'll discuss simple examples that demonstrate self-correction in the presence of symmetry. And then throughout the talk, I'll also be talking about this relationship between thermal stability of topological order, which I'll have to define in some way, because it's not obvious exactly what it is to begin with, and how it relates to self-correction in a precise sense. And then lastly, if we get time, hopefully we can discuss how we should actually achieve this symmetry in these systems, because for the first part of the talk, we're just going to assume that we're handed some symmetry and it comes from nowhere, but then we really want to try and motivate how to achieve these symmetries in practice. And this will be somewhat more speculative toward the end as well. So happy for questions and further discussion there. Okay, what are the rules for a self-correcting quantum memory? So these have been formalized in the so-called Caltech rules, quite well known by now. And so we typically envisage a self-correcting quantum memory as being a many-body spin system where we encode information in the ground space. And so we want this system to be in three dimensions or less. So we want some finite density of spins in three dimensions. And each of these spins should have finite local dimension as well. And we want to have to describe the system by some local Hamiltonian. So each of these terms is supported on some ball of finite radius that doesn't increase with the system size. And each of these terms is of finite strength. So we can't cheat by just like ramping up the strength of the term with the system size. Thirdly, we want some degenerate ground space to encode our information. And this should be perturbatively stable as well. So topologically ordered systems, again, ideal for this. And then this is the important feature, is that when we couple the system to a thermal bath, the lifetime of the information should diverge with the system size without the need for active error correction. And typically, we want this lifetime to grow exponentially with the system size. However, even if we just showed some growth of lifetime, this would still be an interesting proposal. And then finally, after we've let this system evolve for some time, we still need some way of decoding the original information. And so we need some efficient classical decoder. So schematically, the process looks like this. We start with some ground state that we've encoded our information in. We let it evolve under some system bath interaction for time t. And then we look at the reduced state on our actual memory. And we're left with this rho t. And then we hope to perform some error correction mapping, which takes us approximately back to the original state. And then if we can achieve this with a small approximation error for a time that grows exponentially, then we have a self-correcting quantum memory. And so the way that you should think about these systems behaving is that the information is protected energetically. So logical errors should be energetically suppressed. So if we take two ground states, logical zero and logical one, and then we look at local error paths that end up resulting in a logical fault, we can keep track of the energy along as we sequentially apply these local errors. And we look at the minimal energy barrier that needs to be traversed. So this threshold that needs to be crossed in order to implement a logical error through local operations. And this guy is called the energy barrier. And ideally, we want this to be as large as possible, because a phenomenological law is called the Arrhenius law. And this says that the memory time grows exponentially with the energy barrier. This is not, you can break this law with certain examples, but for the most part, this is a pretty good starting point. And so ideally, we want this energy barrier to grow with the system size, because then all we need to do to get a longer lifetime is to just increase the system size, and then the energy barrier will grow with that. And as I said, this is not true in every case, but for most of the models of interest, such as stabilizer Hamiltonians, and even certain 2D projecting models called the 2D quantum doubles, it's proved that you actually need a growing energy barrier to achieve a growing lifetime. And one of the biggest questions is, can we achieve a macroscopic energy barrier in a 3D model? So that is, can we have a energy barrier that grows with the system size in 3D or less? And somehow this is a really tough problem. So if we look at the standard models, the toric code family, we see that it's tough to squeeze this into 3D or less. So firstly, the 2D toric code is the most well-known error correcting code. So it's a very good error correcting code, but how does it fare as a self-correcting quantum memory? Well, we know that it has string-like logical operators, right? And this means that we can produce a logical operator by just starting with a pair of anions, then wrapping them around the lattice and fusing them again. And this implements a logical operation. And this only costed us the energy of producing two excitations. So it has a constant energy cost. And how does this translate into a constant energy time, a constant memory time? Well, we know that these excitations appear at the end of string operators. And if we couple this system to a thermal bath, We rapidly approach configurations where there's a constant density of a uniform density of excitations. So you can divide the lattice up into some grid where each of these lengths is of constant width, and we can guarantee that there's some excitation in each of these grids. And then once we have this uniform density, logical faults are kind of bound to happen because each of these excitations can then wander just some constant distance. So maybe this guy straddles over to this other cell. And then once that's happened, we either have implemented a logical fault or during the decoding step, we'll implement a logical fault. So these excitations only need to walk a constant distance before a logical fault happens. And this means that we have a constant lifetime. And then, of course, we can boost this to some exponential lifetime if we use active error correction. So if we perform error correction steps at a timescale much faster than this timescale that determines this density, we can achieve a good lifetime. The 3D Turok code behaves much in a similar way. The 3D Turok code has two types of logical operators. One is string-like, the other is membrane-like. And so we have these point-like excitations and loop-like excitations. And these point-like excitations lead to the same failure mode as in the 2D model. So again, as we couple to a thermal bath, we get some density of these point-like excitations, and then they wander some constant distance, and then we end up with some logical string error. However, the membrane-like operators, they're suppressed. So the bath has kind of trouble implementing these membrane operators. So we can store some classical information in this system. And this is self-correcting classical memory. And then the 4D Turok code is the first example of a self-correcting quantum memory. So both logical operators in this case are membrane-like. And to grow one of these operators, you need to as you think about growing one of these logical operators, you incur some energy costs proportional to the boundary. And you can draw a lot of intuition from just looking at the 2D Ising model because it behaves in a very similar way. So if we wanted to create a logical operator in the 2D Ising model, we would have to create some droplet of flip spins costing energy proportional to the boundary, and then grow it across the lattice. And so these large loop excitations are penalized by the Boltzmann factor, and they typically don't occur. So we do get an exponential lifetime in the 4D Turok code. And this was first proposed by Dennis et al., and then later proved by Alitsky et al. So the question is, how do we get a self-correcting quantum memory in 3D or less? And there's been a lot of interesting proposals over the years. Many of them have driven entire research directions in condensed matter, the discovery of new interesting models in 3D. And ultimately, all of these fail in some interesting way. So I've just presented four here, four different models, but there's many more that I don't really have time to discuss. But one class of proposals seeks to introduce some coupling, some interaction amongst the anionic excitations in the Turok code. So if you had some effective Hamiltonian that looks like this, Turok code terms are coupled with some interaction term, then you can achieve a self-correction in these type of models. And Pedrocchi et al. Proposed that you could achieve this model by coupling the 2D Turok code to some bosonic bath in 3D, some bosonic gas. However, these proposals ultimately suffer from perturbative instability because as soon as you have these long-range interactions, So these long-range interactions effectively come from the boson field being gapless, and as soon as you gap that out, the interaction strength falls away. And so these long-range interacting anion models are pretty interesting, but they ultimately suffer from perturbative instability. And then there's a number of other models as well, like these fractal models due to Ha, where he was looking for models where there's no string-like no string-like logical operators. as well as these fractal product codes due to Braille. And then another interesting model was these welded codes due to Minsky. And he considered welding lots of 3D toric codes along their boundary. So you have a 3D toric code here, and then it's welded to three other toric codes here. And the idea is that as you try to propagate a string-like logical, it needs to split into three others. And so you end up, the kind of energy cost to produce one of these errors grows with the system size as you start welding these together into more and more. However, there's a variety of no-go theorems that tell us what we can't do. So interestingly, pretty much all 2D models that we normally think about are essentially ruled out. So the 2D stabilizer codes are out. They all have string-like logicals. And then 2D commuting projectors also have a constant energy barrier. And then in 3D, there's a lot of constraints too. So if you have a stabilizer model that has translational invariance as well as scale invariance, and scale invariance here means that the degeneracy doesn't change with the system size, then you necessarily have a string-like logical and therefore a constant energy barrier. And then if you had a stabilizer model in 3D with a non-Clifford gate, then you also have a string-like logical. So these guys are out too. And then Ha has placed bounds on what's possible in 3D translationally invariant models. He shows within his framework that the best you can do are these fractal-like logicals that have a logarithmic energy penalty. And somehow this log seems like a good thing, because you might expect if you apply it to the Arrhenius law, you get a polynomial lifetime. However, this suffers from basically an entropic failure mode. So you do get in the Ha code, you get an increasing memory time up until some critical system size, and then beyond this, there's just too many failure modes. And these dominate the energy cost. So you end up getting a decreasing memory time after some critical length scale. So these guys all have a constant memory time as well. And so the question is, what's an interesting direction where we can avoid these no-go results? And the avenue that we're proposing is to look at symmetry constraints and see if we can avoid some of these harmful error channels using symmetry. So the reason why, there's kind of two basic reasons why you might consider symmetry as an interesting direction. The first is that in the context of topological phases, we already know that symmetry can lead to new and interesting phases of matter, and in particular, ones that were previously trivial can be non-trivial under symmetry. So these are SPT phases and SET phases. And some of these are even topologically stable at non-zero temperature. So it'd be interesting to pursue them as candidate self-correcting quantum memories. And then a second insight is that, of course, symmetry gives constraints on what's possible, what noise the bath can introduce. So when we considered the energy barrier, if we start to consider some harmful error channels as being eliminated by the symmetry, then we might find some way of symmetry protection of the memory. So there's two types of phases, as I mentioned, and we'll be considering both of them in this talk. So if we have some symmetry that's some unitary representation of a group, there's two types of phase that we can get. There's symmetry protected and symmetry enriched. So what are SPT phases? Well, I don't want to define them too carefully, but here are some of the main features of what they are. So we have a short-range entangled bulk, so there's no anionic excitations. So they're kind of trivial in that sense. They're not what we normally think of as being topological. These guys are short-range entangled, which means I can map it to a product state using a low-depth unitary, and they have no topological degeneracy. But the interesting features of these guys always arise when you consider them on a lattice with a boundary. So as soon as you have a boundary, you necessarily get interesting modes on the boundary. And then you can also use these guys to construct interesting topological phases by gauging the symmetry, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later. And then symmetry-enriched phases, well, these are models where you start with an already topologically non-trivial phase, and then you have symmetries on top of this. So We already have a long-range entangled bulk, so we can't map it to a product state using a low-depth unitary. And these guys have anionic excitations in the bulk, and these can have some interesting transformation properties under the symmetry. And then we can also use these symmetries to create interesting defects, and they can have some non-trivial interplay. And a picture that you should have in mind is that some of these SETs are only realizable on the boundary of higher dimensional SPT phases. So this is the class of models that we're really going to be thinking about, where we have a 3D SPT phase in the bulk, and then a 2D SCT phase on the boundary. And as I mentioned, these models are natural candidates because we already start with a confining bulk, so they're short-range entangled with no anionic excitation, so we don't have to worry about anions propagating across the lattice and resulting in a logical error. And secondly, these models have non-trivial boundaries, so that's where we're going to encode our information. So the choices in 3D for what the boundary can be are symmetry breaking, either explicitly or spontaneously. The boundary can be gapless, and if you rule out these two cases, then it must be topologically ordered. And so this will be our goal. We'll be thinking of these SPTs with topologically ordered boundaries, and we want to characterize their feasibility as self-correcting quantum memories. And in particular, we want to focus on whether the topological order is thermally stable in the bulk. And of course, what is the weakest possible symmetry constraint that we can put on these guys? Because you can always put an arbitrarily strong symmetry that just rules out any harmful error channel, and then you get a trivial self-correcting model. But we don't want to consider these models. We want to consider what's the weakest possible symmetry. And then secondly, thirdly, we want to discuss whether this bulk boundary correspondence between SPT and SET phases can persist at non-zero temperature. All right, so this is the framework. 3D SPTs with topological boundaries. We suppose we're given some symmetry, and this is just handed to us. And then the noise that the bath can implement is only noise that commutes with the symmetry. So there's going to be some operators, and they must commute with the symmetry. And then the lifetime in these models will be determined by the symmetric energy barrier. So this is the minimal energy threshold that must be crossed by any sequence of local symmetric operations that results in a logical fault. And what can we say already? Well, let's talk about the on-site symmetries. These are the most commonly considered symmetries for these types of models. And on-site symmetry means that we have some global symmetry operator, SG, but it factors into some local parts. So after perhaps grouping of sites together, we have a local action of the symmetry, UG, and then the global symmetry is just the tensor product of all these guys. And what happens when you put these models on a system with a boundary? Well, you look at the symmetry action on these boundary degrees of freedom. So we have a bulk Hamiltonian, and then once we introduce a boundary, we have some new boundary degrees of freedom. And when you look at the symmetry action on these boundary degrees of freedom, it transforms in general in this way. So we have an N component and an R component. And this R component is just the regular on-site action of the symmetry. And then this N component is some anomaly. So it prevents you from realizing the symmetry in an on-site way. And in general, this N is just some local circuit, so some low-depth circuit that's diagonal in this group basis. And then once we have this action, so I can just consider the action of the symmetry on the boundary without worrying about the bulk, we have some type of dimensional reduction. So for a 3D bulk, we can just look at the 2D boundary. And then the only constraint is that operators must respect this potentially anomalous symmetry action here. However, we know that these 2D models are unstable on the boundary on their own. But if we have this symmetry, it doesn't provide any extra protection. So you can show that this type of symmetry here is not very restrictive. So you can always find string operators that propagate along this 2D boundary, and they result in some logical fault. And so the symmetric energy barrier for these type of models is still constant. and the memory time is also constant. So these guys with on-site symmetries do not produce interesting quantum memories. And so the analogous question is, can the SPT order and these models survive at non-zero temperature? And well, firstly, what does this even mean, SPT order at non-zero temperature? Well, we're going to be looking at the Gibbs ensemble of this system, and we ask, how close is it to a classical ensemble? So a classical ensemble is the Gibbs state of some classical Hamiltonian. A classical Hamiltonian is just a Hamiltonian that's diagonal in a local basis. And the question is, can we map from a classical Hamiltonian to the Gibbs state of interest using only a low-depth circuit? And then more formally, what we need to do is we allow ourselves some extra degrees of freedom on each site. And then once we do that, we define a classical Hamiltonian. And then you see, under symmetric low-depth circuits, can I produce my Gibbs state of interest? And if you can, you say that the model's trivial because it looks essentially like a classical state up to a low-depth circuit. And in some previous work with Alex and Benny, we showed that there's no thermal SPT with on-site symmetries. So I don't want to go into all the details, but you can kind of get a feel for it using this sketch here. So what we do is we start with the Hamiltonian, and then we remove terms with some probability. And if you choose this probability right, you can show that you're not introducing too much error in your approximation. So this Hamiltonian with removed terms approximates well the thermal state. And then these missing terms we can think of as sinks, where excitations can be created or destroyed for free. And then once we have these sinks, we can produce some symmetric disentangler. And we can disentangle all the terms around each sink and then grow this out. So we divide the lattice up into some grid. These red dots are sinks. And now we can sequentially apply this disentangler to disentangle the entire lattice. And then what we're left with is some trivial Gibbs state. So it looks like the Gibbs ensemble of a non-interacting model. Right, so these last two slides, what we've seen is that for on-site symmetries, there's no topological order at non-zero temperature in terms of circuit depth, and these models aren't self-correcting. So we need to look beyond the on-site symmetries to find something interesting. And there's lots of different proposals and lots of recent interest in these so-called subsystem symmetries. So these can take various forms. Some are line-like operators. So instead of acting on the same, on the whole lattice, they act on lines or on fractal-like structures. Or in the case of higher forms, they act on closed codimension K submanifolds. And so we already know that these line-like and these fractal-like are going to fail for similar reasons as the on-site case. And so we're going to look at these higher form symmetries. And so what a higher form symmetry is it's indexed by some K, some integer K, and you say it's a K-form symmetry if for every closed codimension K surface, you have some symmetry operator there. So on this funky 2D manifold, we have some symmetry operator. And then we have operators for every such submanifold. And notably, when we reduce to the k equals zero case, this means we're looking at the codimension zero manifold, submanifold, so it's the whole lattice, we return to the on-site case. And so increasing k, it constitutes a family of symmetries with increasing strength. So the zero form is the weakest case, and then the one form is the next weakest case, and so on. And so we'll be interested in this one form case. And now I'll just walk you through a simple example of a model that does exhibit self-correction under this one-form symmetry. So we're going to have some bulk Hamiltonian and some boundary Hamiltonian, and then the symmetry is going to be a one-form symmetry, which in 2D looks like operators on closed two-dimensional surfaces. And this kind of seems a bit abstract, these K-form symmetries, but I'll give you a concrete example in a second. The bulk Hamiltonian will be some type of cluster state. It's going to be originally due to Rausendorf, Bravi, and Harrington. The boundary Hamiltonian will be a toric code, but with some dressed terms. So it'll have some, it'll look like the toric code essentially up to some dressing. And then the symmetry is this one-form symmetry, which we'll have two copies of. So let's zoom in a bit. What does the bulk Hamiltonian look like? Well, we start with a cubic lattice. And on each face and on each edge, we place a qubit. So all the qubits on the faces will be labeled green, and all those on the edges will be labeled blue. And then the Hamiltonian is this cluster term on this lattice. So we have a term for each face and for each edge. The terms on the faces look like an exit on the qubit on the face, and then z's on the surrounding edges. And then similarly for the edge terms, we're going to have an x on the edge and then z on the four faces incident to this edge. So the ground state of this model is the cluster state. And this is a model that's has low depth entanglement, so you can prepare it with a depth 2 circuit. And the symmetry is given by these two-dimensional surface operators with Pauli X on all of them. So here's one type of example. So we have this two-dimensional surface here, and we just apply Pauli X to all of the green qubits on this face. And then we would have similar operators for the blue sublattice as well. And importantly, these operators can be, so the full symmetry, the full one-form symmetry group can be generated by operators of this type. So we have these cell operators and these vertex operators, but importantly, under like a lattice duality, you can relate these to these. So they both kind of look like cell operators is the point. And you can check that these operators commute with our Hamiltonian because in particular, they can be formed by products of them. So the product of all the cluster terms around this cell gives this operator. And all of these guys commute with each other as well. I should have mentioned that. So this is a stabilizer Hamiltonian, and this is the symmetry group. So what does the boundary look like? Well, we just terminate our cubic lattice in this nice way. So this is just the boundary of the cubic lattice, and we only put edge qubits there. So there's no green qubits on the faces anymore. And this is because we're going to be interested in putting some toric code here. And so if we have this bulk Hamiltonian and now we just have these blue degrees of freedom on the boundary, we need to know what the algebra that describes these boundary degrees of freedom is. And so we do this by finding these canonical pairs of logical operators for the boundary modes, and they look almost like just regular Pauli operators, but with a slight dressing. So the Z just looks like a normal Z, and the X looks like an X, but with a Z into the bulk. And so these type of operators anti-commute with each other, and then commute with the bulk Hamiltonian. And now we use these operators to construct a toric code. So we have the normal star and vertex terms, the stars and the plaquette. The plaquette term looks the same as the usual plaquette. It's just the product of z's around some face. And the vertex term has the product of x's around a vertex, but also with these dressings into the bulk. So again, all of these terms commute with each other and with the bulk Hamiltonian. And if we choose the boundary conditions in the right way, so here we'll be interested in choosing planar boundary conditions, we can encode a single qubit, and we have these string-like logical operators. So the normal, we get the normal Z logical, as well as the X one, but it's a bit dressed. And now the question is, what are the excitations in this model? So in the bulk, we have we can flip cluster terms by just applying Pauli Z operators. We have this relation, so a cluster term commutes, a Z anti-commutes with a cluster term on the when it's on the same site, and then they commute otherwise. And this forms a complete set of the excitations. And these excitations are symmetric, meaning they can be implemented by the bath in a symmetric way, if and only if they form closed loops. And then on the boundary, we have the normal, the interesting thing about the boundary will be that the normal toric code excitations, the E's and the M's, can only exist if they're at the boundaries of strings that come from the bulk. So let's see what this means exactly by this example. So we take a normal string operator, a dressed string operator, and this is going to produce some M excitations here on the boundary. However, this is not a symmetric operator, because you can find these symmetry terms that terminate on the boundary, and they anti-commute with these strings. So the only way that these excitations can exist is if we have some bulk excitation of z's that terminate on this boundary as well. And another way of viewing this is that this boundary symmetry term here, so this guy here is really, it looks like this. This guy couples the bulk and the boundary. So you can get this guy by taking the toric code Plaquette term as well as the product of the cluster terms on this cell. And so this is a really important feature of the model, is that the bulk and the boundary are coupled by this symmetry. And from this, we see also that there is an energy barrier in the model, because if we were to consider creating a pair of toric code excitations and then moving them apart, this must come at the expense of some bulk string excitation. And these bulk string excitations cost energy that's proportional to their length. So what we get is actually an effective tension between the boundary excitations. And you can show that any error channel that comes from that's comprised of symmetric local errors and results in a logical error must traverse an energy barrier that grows with the system size. So we actually get this energy barrier that's order L, where L is the linear size of the lattice. And then from this, we actually get an exponential lifetime of this memory, provided we're below some critical temperature. If the temperature goes too high, then these strings actually start proliferating across the lattice, and then the memory is no longer stable. And so we have this example of a symmetry protected self-correction. And then the question is, is it SPT ordered at non-zero temperature? And it turns out that yes, it is the case that this model is SPT ordered at non-zero temperature. So you can't map this the Gibbs state of this bulk to a classical Hamiltonian up to some local unitary that's symmetric, as well as addition or removal of some ancillas. And there's many ways of showing this. So the first way is kind of more analytical. You find some non-local error, some non-local operators, and these form order parameters. And at zero temperature, you can show that they distinguish the trivial phase and the non-trivial phase. And then at non-zero temperature, you can apply error correction to these operators and show that they still distinguish these phases. The second kind of more interesting way is that this bulk cluster model can produce a non-trivial domain wall in the 4D toric code. So there's this procedure called gauging, and I probably won't get into too much of the details now, but you can just think of it as a duality map. And if you take the Rausendorff-Bravi-Harrington cluster state, as well as some trivial non-interacting model, and you gauge it, and then you also have to unfold it a little bit, what you end up is with two 4D toric codes, and they're coupled by this domain wall here. And this domain wall exchanges excitations. So in the 4D toric code, we have two types of excitations, these M's and these E's. And upon crossing the domain wall, they're exchanged. And so this fact that this domain wall is non-trivial, implements a non-trivial exchange of the excitations, means that the underlying SPT order of this thing had to be distinct from the trivial model. And then at non-zero temperature, you can show that this domain wall is also thermally stable, because the loop braiding processes in the 4D toric code persist even at non-zero temperature due to the stability of the 4D toric code. And then you might ask, well, why do we need to go through all this this kind of cluster bulk and all this stuff? Like, why didn't you just apply the symmetry to a toric code on the boundary of some trivial model? Maybe the symmetry is just the only thing that's making this work. And it turns out that it's not the case that you can get the same result using a trivial bulk using the toric code on the boundary. So if we had this trivial paramagnet in the bulk and then the usual toric code, you actually only get a constant energy barrier in this case as well. And then because you need this SPT owner in the bulk to couple the boundary and the bulk. And this is actually an instantiation of the bulk boundary correspondence, but at non-zero temperature. And then if you view the energy barrier as a topological invariant, this gives you a third proof that the bulk is SPT ordered, because the trivial model had a constant energy barrier, and this model had a linear energy barrier. And so this energy barrier distinguishes the two phases as well. And there's a bunch of other models that you can apply this to, this procedure. So that they all demonstrate quite similar behavior. So we can take the 3D gauge color code, originally due to Bombin, and choose a particular gauge fixed version of this where all the information is located on the boundary of some lattice, and then we have some trivial bulk. And then using the symmetries that's obtained by the stabilizers of the gauge color code, we can also achieve this same confinement of anions on the boundary. And then we also have foliated stabilizer codes. So this Rausendorf-Brawing-Harrington state is really just the simplest example of a foliated 2D code. You take the 2D toric code and you foliate and you get this model. You can apply this to any stabilizer, topological stabilizer model, and get a similar result. And these models are all just simpler examples of these Walker-Wang models, but enriched by symmetries. And now the question is, can these symmetries be emergent? And so what we're going to do is we're going to draw some inspiration from the 2D toric code. So this model has already a Z2 parity symmetry of the excitations. So you can only produce excitations in pairs or destroy them in pairs. And this is actually a local symmetry. However, what is the symmetry operator that detects this? It's just a property of the Hamiltonian alone, and there was no extra symmetry there. So how do we make sense of this? And what Kataev said is that you can, of course, always find a symmetry if you just introduce some redundant degrees of freedom, and then that are fixed into some particular state. And so we can actually find dualities between models with symmetries that are enforced and symmetries that are emergent, using this gauging procedure. So this is the toric code, just the usual toric code with degrees of freedom on edges, and then we have the usual Plaquette and star terms. And then if we introduced a green degree of freedom, so just another qubit to each vertex, and then we just restrict that to be in a fixed state, we haven't really changed the model too much, but we've just introduced some larger Hilbert space and then restricted to some subset of it. But then you can apply some local unitary, which is just a product of C knots. And you get what's known as the Z2 gauge theory. And so this Z2 gauge theory has a Hilbert space, which is a qubit for each green qubit and for each blue qubit. And so this is a much larger Hilbert space than the toric code. However, we only consider states that are in the +1 eigenspace of this symmetry operator, this gauge symmetry operator, which is X on a green qubit and then X on all the blue qubits surrounding it. So this is some funky Hilbert space. And we're only allowed to consider operators here which commute with this symmetry as well.
Sorry, but the local unitary you're doing has high depth, right?
No. This one's local. So actually, if you apply C naught along all of these edges, just like every edge between a green and a blue qubit, that's how you map between these two states. So in particular, the X here would get maps to X, 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 which is the gauge symmetry operator.
Okay, but there's no, but there's no low depth circuit connecting the topological trivial.
Are you talking about this unitary here? Sorry?
Is that one's high?
That one's, yeah, very non-local. So the unitary that maps between toric code and gauge theory is just a local one.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Right. This one's highly non-local. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this gauge mapping it's a locality preserving map. So it actually, it maps within this symmetric sector, local terms to local terms. However, it cannot be realized by a local unitary. So that's an important thing. So we have this duality between the Z2 paramagnet and the Z2 Turing code. And this one has no symmetry operators. This one does. So this operator here says I can only create pairs of excitations. And here, it just is a fact of the Hamiltonian. So this is an interesting kind of motivation, but this is really just the 2D models with on-side symmetries. And so what we want to do is try and move this towards the higher form regime. And so you can actually do gauging.
Sorry, but then going back, I mean, I don't understand what the moral I'm supposed to take from this example is. I mean, you have, there's a duality, but mm-hmm. it's a totally non-local duality, so the noise is totally
in these two models. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So I'm not interested exactly here in locality or not. All I'm trying to draw attention to is the fact that, so in these models, all we care about is the property of the excitations. So in the previous model, we wanted 1D excitations, and that to be the only case. Here, if we only cared about pairs of excitations, so here we have a symmetry. Say we only wanted excitations to come in pairs. Well, we would impose this symmetry here. But then you'd be like, oh, this is not like a, you're enforcing some symmetry, you're trying to cheat. But then it turns out we can find a dual model where excitations naturally come in pairs and we didn't have to enforce any symmetry. So I'm not necessarily thinking about whether local noise gets mapped to local noise or anything, just the property of the excitations.
Okay, maybe I can see what you're gonna do with this, but I thought the point of this was to say, well, we can create some model that has the symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess, yeah, the point is we're gonna try and find some model that's dual to the model with the symmetry enforced.
But the other properties of these models are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
They're dual, but their behavior under noise is totally different.
That's definitely true. All that we're caring about at this moment is just whether we can find a model where the symmetry can be emergent. So not even at the stage of trying to find the model I only want to know if the symmetry can be emergent or not on the excitations. I'm not.
You don't care about the noise happening.
Not at this stage.
Great.
Maybe we'll come back to it in like two slides or so, and then see.
But if you're interested, say in local noise, you know that this mapping preserves the locality. So if you have some local errors, they will be mapped to local errors.
That's also true. I mean,
right. Symmetric.
But
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Only the symmetric local operators here get mapped to local operators here. But your point is that there's also just a vast difference between these systems. Like this one can encode a qubit, this one can't. Yeah. But we'll come back to that. I'm only caring about symmetries at this stage. Right. So we want to apply this gauging mapping to higher form symmetries as well. And this has been done in several other works. So for both subsystem symmetries and higher form symmetries. And recent work by Kubica and Yoshida show that you can actually gauge several copies of this Rausendorf-Bravi-Harrington model with these one-form symmetries to achieve a particular gauge color code model. And so we're only viewing this as evidence in favor of gauge color code stability. So this is the gauge color code model. We have some 3D lattice. It has certain colorability and certain valence properties. And we have terms on each face. So qubits are located on the vertices, and we have x term for each face and a z term for each face. And this Hamiltonian here is a candidate model. So Bombin conjectured that it would be self-correcting. However, it's too hard to study. It's very frustrated. And there's really no tractable way to obtain the spectral information. However, this gauging mapping kind of gives us hope that this model might be self-correcting because it behaves in a very similar way because we have many product constraints in this model, and so all the excitations are loop-like, just as in the Rausendorf-Bravi-Harrington model. And the bulk and the boundary are also coupled. So you can find logical operators that are just supported entirely on one boundary facet, but the excitations that run along these boundaries must also be coupled to the bulk. And so the question is, can you view this as being the enforcement of some one-form symmetry in an emergent way?
What happens if you just gauge one copy of the RPH? What do you get?
It doesn't give you anything interesting. So if you gauge one copy, it just Hadamards it, which is kind of funny. But
I mean, you get some like 3D topological order?
It's still short-range entangled. It's kind of strange that it does that. If you gauge the trivial model under one-form symmetries, you get a toric code phase. But if you gauge this single copy of RBH model, then you essentially get the RBH model back. Somehow a bit pathological. So this is sort of the more speculative end, but I think it motivates further study of this gauge color code model. And there's a second hint, but I think I should probably try and wrap up now. So here's the summary of what we found is that when you consider SPTs with on-site symmetries, they're neither topologically ordered nor self-correcting. And similarly with the trivial model with one-form symmetries. However, if we look at a non-trivial SPT with one-form symmetries, we do get self-correction and topological order. And then we can kind of compare this to the other results. So 2D commuting projectors, neither topologically ordered nor self-correcting. Similarly with the fractal models. And then the 4D toric code also satisfies this condition. So with symmetry, you can kind of buy yourself a dimension. And the question is, can we realize this symmetry in a more physical way? And you shouldn't be able to do it with a commuting model because of all the previous no-go theorems, but maybe the gauge color code is just enough to avoid these no-go theorems. That's the conclusion from this side, is to try and find more duality. So gauging is one such example. And so some questions are as follows. We from what we've seen, it seems like these one-form symmetries are quite important for self-correction. And can they emerge in a more realistic way? One avenue of attacking this problem is to find more solvable models of the gauge color code phase. So it has a very rich phase structure that's pretty much unexplored. And finding certain exactly solvable points, although non-commuting points, is an interesting direction. And I've been working on this with Thomas a bit, so I'm happy to talk about that a bit later if you're interested. And moreover, these boundaries on this RBH model that we saw, they actually, in a similar way that the RBH model corresponded to a domain wall in the 4D toric code, the boundaries of these model correspond to defects in the 4D toric code. And so it would appear that they're thermally stable as well. I think there's still a need for a good physical picture for single-shot error correction. So single-shot, in normal error correction, your syndrome measurements might actually be noisy, so you get incorrect syndrome measurement on each time interval. So you need to repeat the measurements many times to locate measurement errors. But certain codes can admit single-shot error correction, where you only need a single round of syndrome measurements to obtain reliable information, such as the gauge color code admits single-shot error correction. And Bomben showed that this is actually related to self-correction. So anytime you have a self-correcting quantum memory with some minor extra constraints, the code is also single-shot. So it'd be interesting, though, to find some more physical underpinnings of single-shot error correction. And then also finding more of these dualities with subsystem codes. In the 2D model, this gauging related this emergent and this enforced symmetry, so it'd be interesting to see that more. And then there's been a lot of recent work in closed system thermalization. So you can consider models with some extra fields, and the system sort of self-thermalizes. So you consider the evolution of the system under its unitary dynamics. And then you look at the reduced state of this model, and it looks thermal after some time. This somehow is not the right error model that we think about in quantum information. We always think about as coupling to some thermal bath. But there's been lots of interesting things that you can say in these closed system thermalizing systems. So there's a lot of work on pre-thermalization and localization, as well as these approximate conservation laws that come out of it. It'd be nice to actually connect these two frameworks a bit more. And then I was trying to motivate that this notion of thermal topological order that we had is the right notion because it connects well with self-correction, but it would also be worthwhile, I think, exploring different definitions. Okay, that's it, I think. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Model you consider with Thomas, could it be viewed as a gauge fixed version of the gauge color code, or it's like gauge color code inspired model?
Yeah, it's gauge code color code inspired model, but I don't think it's a gauge fixed version. So it's certainly within the stabilizer space of the Hamiltonian. So it's somewhere in the code space. Like the ground space of this model is somewhere within the code space, but it's not. It's not exactly, I mean, I guess in that sense, then you can view it as a gauge fixed version. Okay. But the Hamiltonian doesn't naturally carry that interpretation, so.
So putting aside self-correction for the moment, I mean, topologically ordered phases, non-trivial topological order phases, are quantum error correcting codes.
Mm-hmm.
Is it also the case that a non-trivial SPG phase is necessarily a quantum code against symmetry protected noise or noise respecting the symmetry?
So I think that direction hasn't been explored so much, but in a sense the answer is yes. In that first of all, you need the SPT needs to have boundaries to encode to have any degeneracy,
okay.
And then once you have that, once you consider noise that's only
non-trivial topology.
No, it's still non-degenerate.
Okay.
Only in the presence of boundaries do you have any degeneracy,
okay.
And then certainly in 3D, if you look at the boundaries of these systems, they're going to be topologically ordered anyway, but in 2D. The boundaries can be either gapless or symmetry breaking, so you're only going to get like a repetition code on the boundary of a 2D SPT. So I don't think they're particularly useful candidates, but I think.
Sorry, I mean, but you can still view the whole thing as a quantum error correcting code,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of what you were doing here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then whether it's repetition, you just mean that the particular symmetry that you have is just enforcing like classical bit flips or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the kind of the more interesting direction is to look at them as resources for measurement-based quantum computation. Yeah.
Is that understood what the nature of this finite temperature phase transition is? Do you know what a universality class this might be?
That's a good question. I'm not too sure actually. So we can only put a lower bound on the critical temperature, so we don't even necessarily explore all the way up to criticality. We just look at the low temperature regime and just understand that that's a stable phase. But that would be an interesting thing to pursue.
Coming in.